Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jeff Moore on behalf of Texas Instruments. This morning, Your Honor, I'd like to introduce my co-counsel from the Jones Day Firm in Dallas, Texas. Closest to me is Mr. Tom Jackson. Behind Mr. Jackson is Mr. Joe McEntee. And on the far side of the table is Mr. Terry Murphy. With the court's permission, Mr. Murphy will be addressing the court this morning.
Okay, well, good morning. Welcome to the court, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justice Holland.
Members of
the court. John Abrams appearing on behalf of Appellant Qualcomm Incorporated. May it please the court, Qualcomm is here today asking this court to review two rulings made by the court of chancery in favor of Texas Instruments after the court determined that Texas Instruments had violated a patent portfolio agreement between Texas Instruments and Qualcomm. Turning first to TI's breach of its obligation to treat the terms of that patent portfolio agreement confidential, there's no question here that TI violated its obligation to keep the terms of the patent portfolio agreement confidential. At its annual conference for industry analysts back in May 2003, where TI was proudly announcing its entry into the part of the cell phone market that Qualcomm does business, TI senior officers repeatedly disclosed the royalty term in the agreement to the assembled analysts and members of the press, even though those senior officers knew that they were under confidentiality obligation not to disclose those terms. As we see from the record, TI's announcement had its intended effect. The analysts and the press picked up on that and broadcast that confidential royalty provision from the PPA in reports about TI's entry into this part of the cell phone market, positioning TI as a serious competitor with Qualcomm. Soon after that breach, Qualcomm sued TI, seeking a declaration that Texas Instruments had materially breached the terms of the PPA and that Qualcomm was entitled to the remedies that the parties had agreed upon under the agreement, including the termination of TI's rights under the agreements. Then in retaliation, TI sued Qualcomm. Knowing that it had no defense to Qualcomm's claim, it appears that TI simply made up its own claim against Qualcomm based on some trumped-up allegations that Qualcomm had somehow given other customers more favorable terms than had given to TI in some fictional world that even TI had to admit in this case never existed. TI then moved to dismiss Qualcomm's claim on the confidentiality breach, arguing that as a matter of law, a breach of confidentiality in this context could never rise to the level of a material breach, and that TI's breach of the confidentiality obligation was not a material breach of the agreement. The Chancellor properly denied TI's motion to dismiss and explicitly recognized the controlling legal test to be applied in these circumstances to determine whether or not TI's breach rose to the level of a material breach. He said it's a fact-specific inquiry that's done on a case-by-case basis, and to perform that fact-specific inquiry, New York courts, the applicable law here is New York law, use the five-factor test set out in the restatement of contracts as a guide to determine whether a breach rises to the level of a material breach.
We know that the Chancellor determined that there was no material breach. Did he determine, however, that there was a breach?
Yes, Your Honor. He did determine that there was a breach, and we're here today because he says that breach didn't rise to, on summary judgment, that breach didn't rise to the level of a material breach.
Well, if the Chancellor is correct in that regard, is the consequence of that that your client has no remedy or simply does not have determination, the asymmetrical termination?
Yes, they say the asymmetrical termination remedy, and the answer, Your Honor, is that we are not limited, we are not shut out, and we have, the answer is not that we have no remedy, it's that we do not have the termination remedy if the breach is not found to be material. But here we think the facts and circumstances show that it is a material breach, and that whether there is a material breach here could not be determined on summary judgment because the materiality of the breach that Texas Instruments committed can't be determined simply from the face of the agreement. The court, however, on summary judgment, without applying the controlling legal test, simply found that the breach was not material, and that's why we're here today. It's important to remember, however, that after the motion to dismiss, the court sent us out and said, well, I think that I need a record that shows the true extent of the TI's breach of the confidentiality obligation and the corresponding impact of that breach. So we went out and gathered that evidence, and what did it show? Well, the evidence plainly showed that TI willfully and flagrantly breached its obligations to keep the terms of the agreement confidential, and that that breach had a substantial detrimental impact on Qualcomm's business.
And that's where you get into the discussion about the arrangement with Intel?
Yes, Justice Hall. Yes.
And as I understand it, the Chancellor said the negotiations with Intel might have fallen apart for other reasons, but as I understand your response to that, it's all part of the factual dispute that couldn't be resolved on summary judgment.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I don't want the court to believe that the evidence that we brought before the court on summary judgment was limited to that. It was much deeper than that. And most importantly, we brought forward evidence that is not discussed in the summary judgment opinion that shows that TI's breach was a willful breach of the agreement. We brought evidence before the court, unrebutted evidence before the court, that these senior executives at TI who made the disclosures knew that they shouldn't have made the disclosures and yet willfully made the disclosures because they wanted to better position TI in the marketplace that Qualcomm was already operating in. And the willfulness of TI's breach is particularly important here because in applying this multi-factor facts and circumstances test, the courts have recognized that there's great weight to be placed on the willfulness of the breach. And where the breach, as here, is willful, the court finds that there's less emphasis on the other factors of the test because the willfulness of the breach doesn't necessarily require the breach to have to go so closely to a complete defeat of the object of the parties in making the agreement that it defeats the object of the parties in making the agreement.
Could you go back to, to where you were talking about what the impact of the breach was and
yes,
what
right.
your evidence was of that?
Yes. The impact of the breach, Your Honor, was clear before the Vice Chancellor on the summary judgment record. And here, it's somewhat unique in that we sort of have a controlled experiment. While the total impact of this breach, that is, what is the damage to Qualcomm when Intel gives away confidential business information? What impact does that have on other agreements that Qualcomm is negotiating? In many cases, I'm sure the answer is we'll never know. In this particular case, though, we brought forward evidence that showed that Qualcomm was in negotiations with Intel over a royalty-paying license for the same set of intellectual property on CDMA technology for cell phones. Qualcomm was willing to pay, that we're talking about, paying $30 million for access to our intellectual property. And as soon as they heard this disclosure that TI wasn't paying anything, Intel came to us and said, the toothpaste is out of the tube. There's no way that we're paying anything for that technology if TI doesn't pay for that technology. And so we believe that that is clear evidence of at least part of the damages that Qualcomm suffered in this case from the disclosure of the very core term of this agreement that TI had with Qualcomm. They destroyed our competitive position in the market. That is precisely the benefit of the bargain that we had negotiated with them, and they threw it out the window in an effort to try to improve their position in the market.
Going back to your argument about willful violation, what's your response to the other side's contention that willful violation argument was not presented fairly to the Chancellor?
Well, Your Honor, we have always argued throughout this case that it is a multi-factor test that should be applied, and one of the factors in that multi-factor test is the good faith of the party, good or bad faith of the party, who made the breach. And so while it may or may not be that we use the words a willful breach reduces the balancing of the other factors in the multi-factor test, we've always said that they, in bad faith, breached the confidentiality term of this agreement. And moreover, I think we're free under the court rules to invent any legal theory on which we want the court to reverse the Chancellor so long as it's consistent with the arguments we made below, and that's what we do here today.
But is it consistent? You're arguing that the level of materiality, the degree of the burden is less because of that particular factor. Isn't that something that, if you're serious about that argument, you should have argued to the trial court?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a matter of emphasis, really. We've always argued this five-factor test, and particularly willfulness as it relates to the bad faith of Texas Instruments breach has always been it. We have not placed such emphasis on it to say it ought to lower the importance of the other factors. And here we are saying that there are courts who have said that that last factor, the fifth factor of the multi-factor test, really can, in certain circumstances, be given more weight than the other factors. So we don't believe it's inconsistent, and we don't try to overweight that factor necessarily here at this court, nor do we have to. The core of our argument here is that the chancellor recognized the appropriate test, this multi-factor test that includes the willfulness of the breach as the fifth factor, in his motion to dismiss opinion, and then on summary judgment did not apply it, but rather truncated it, and truncated it unfairly in the sense that there was evidence before the court that showed that if the multi-factor test were applied, that we should at least get to trial, if not have summary judgment awarded in favor of Qualcomm.
Well, I know you disagree with the chancellor, but help me understand how he got to what appears to be his position, and that is everybody just wanted patent peace. And it really didn't matter to your client whether everyone knew about this agreement or they did know about the agreement, even though you put this confidentiality provision in there. He appears to be saying that there are some things that are material and I can find them as a matter of law. And there are other things, even though they're in there, I can find as a matter of law, don't make any difference. How could you do that?
Well, we asked the same question, Your Honor. How could the chancellor do that? Here, a couple of things. One, it's important to remember that although patent peace is called out as one of the material terms of the agreement, in the analysis of whether someone's breach rises to the level of a material breach, the law doesn't limit the court to finding if it's a material goal that's breached, then it's a material breach. It doesn't work that way. You could breach any portion of the agreement, and that can rise to the level of a material breach. And here, importantly, patent peace was not the only purpose of the agreement. Although patent peace was called out as an important and material factor of the agreement, it's not the only purpose of this agreement.
Your position is that you're entitled to have a trial where you can put on evidence that demonstrates why confidentiality was important and material to you.
Yes, Your Honor. And more specifically, we're entitled to a trial to show why TI's breach rises to the level of materiality given the context in which they breached this agreement. And the chancellor himself recognized in his motion to dismiss opinion that the courts are not limited to looking only at what is defined as a material role of the breach or a central purpose of the agreement and determine whether or not there's a material breach. That's why he cited the Frank Felix case. That's why he sent us off to develop this record. Unexplainedly, at summary judgment, the court comes back and doesn't weigh that evidence, doesn't consider that evidence in his opinion, and simply says, I'm going to look only at the face of the agreement. And I see this is called out as a material goal, and I see that the general counsel of Qualcomm said, well, we still have patent peace in the sense that they haven't sued us. I think in context, it's important to keep in mind what was going on here. What happened was Qualcomm was the pioneer of CDMA technology, which is one way to package information that goes onto cell phones, to put it in the most generic way. Texas Instruments had placed this emphasis on GSM technology. Texas Instruments came to Qualcomm and said, we'd like a license so that we can play in the CDMA market, because once people started bundling services like pictures and more data over the phone lines, it was a better technology to use. So they came to us and wanted to use Qualcomm's intellectual property. There is no doubt that the bargain that Qualcomm was going to strike with Texas Instruments was going to first ensure that Qualcomm would not lose its position in the market. It wasn't going to give away its two-tiered licensing program. It wasn't going to put Texas Instruments in the same position as Qualcomm was in. Texas Instruments needed a license from us, and we weren't going to give it at any cost. And that's why it was so important for us to have this confidentiality provision put in there. And that wasn't surprising to anybody. That's what these sophisticated commercial parties do in cases like this. In fact, the NDA that they had to sign before they even began negotiations required all the parties to not even disclose that they were in negotiations. Qualcomm would not have entered into this agreement, and it's quite plain from the evidence that was before the chancellor, if we couldn't be sure that Texas Instruments was not going to tell the world that they had a royalty-free license. There was no way we would have entered into that. Ron, I see I've gotten to my rebuttal time. Unless the court has questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Very well.
May it please the court.
Good morning,
Your Honor. My name is Terry Murphy, representing TI, Texas Instruments, and I'd first of all like to thank the court for the permission it granted me to argue before this court. I consider it an honor. I'd like to address the question raised by counsel, and that is whether the Court of Chancery was correct when it held that TI's breach of the confidentiality provision was not so material as to require a one-way termination, leaving Qualcomm with a claim for damages, which was set for trial, which we were originally told was $30 million, which their expert said was $18 million, which we hired an expert and were prepared to try, and they dropped the case on their own and never proceeded to damages. So our position is, under the contract and clearly under New York law, this seems to be the morning for New York law here, under New York law, the termination was not an appropriate remedy, but damages was. To put it another way, was the breach of confidentiality, did it destroy the agreement? Did it take the essence of the agreement, the core of the agreement, and destroy it? Was this contract dead on arrival because we breached the confidentiality agreement? The answer to that is clearly no, and the answer is that the Court of Chancery got it correct.
Well, before we get to the answer being clearly no, tell us how we get to that answer on a paper record, because normally when someone's talking about whether the agreement was destroyed or not, one party says, let me tell you why it was destroyed. The other party says, let me tell you why it wasn't destroyed. And there's this dispute of fact. And we normally see this after a trial.
That, Justice Holland, I think that's the key question here. And my answer to that is where I was going next, and that is there's a disconnect, I believe, between what Chancellor Chandler did and the evidence he looked at and what Qualcomm is claiming. Qualcomm stands before this court and said we never got a fact hearing. The evidence is, and the questions are fact intensive. It's really a two-step analysis. Step one is you can look at the four corners of the agreement. And when you look at the four corners of the agreement, you say, what is the material goals of this contract? What is this contract all about? The second step is where you look at the facts to see if those facts rose to the level of materiality. Both sides agree the contract's ambiguous. What is the goal? What is the essence of the contract? Remember, New York law says in order to terminate as opposed to get damages, the contract, you have to decide whether the breach destroyed the essence or core of the agreement. The chancellor was able to look at the agreement on all four, as this court can do, and see that it's pretty easy. The core of the agreement is a cross-license agreement or a covenant not to sue. Simply put, patent peace. As a matter of fact, it says in the preamble, a material goal of this contract is freedom from patent litigation.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's assume there's a large law firm that hires a lot of associates. It can either be in a single city or multiple cities, and they have agreements with their associates. And one of the agreements says this has to remain confidential. And then the associate discloses what they're being paid, which is significantly more than either everybody else in the firm or everybody else in the country. It probably caused a little bit of concern throughout the law firm.
You're asking the right guy.
Good. What I'm saying is it seems difficult generally to resolve how important that breach of confidence is on summary judgment.
Well, the answer to your question, Justice Holland, is it depends, I believe, on what that contract is between that particular associate and the firm. A, whether or not there was a confidentiality and whether that went to the court. There is a case, Thomas versus HUD, which they rely on, which the HUD employee got demoted. He brought a grievance, and he was going to be pushed out the door, and of course the settlement agreement was, you keep your mouth shut, Mr. HUD, as to why I was fired, and I'll hang around here, but then I'll leave, and when I try and get a new job, no one will know that I was demoted. There it was easy for the court to say confidentiality was the core of that agreement, because that was the basis upon which the employee gave up his grievance.
Well, what they seem to be saying, at least with Intel by analogy, is the reason we wanted you to keep it confidential is even though we had this mutual exchange and we got patent peace, there are other people that would want similar arrangements, and we may want some money from them. And if they know you got it without consideration, everyone else is going to want the same deal.
Well, they should have said that in the contract, because the contract, if you look at the contract, it's not only patent peace. It's no pass-through rights. And this is important in connection with the Intel, because you have to put Intel within this scheme. The primary business of Qualcomm is to sell chips to handset manufacturers, the phone guys, the phone set. They also get over $1 billion from those handset manufacturers in royalties. They are concerned if they sell to a TI or another ASIC, which is a chip maker, if they sell a chip to TI and then TI sells to that same handset manufacturer, they're concerned that they would, through patent exhaustion, the handset guy wouldn't be paying royalties. That's what they were concerned about. As a matter of fact, it is stipulated, or it is at least said, in the brief filed by Qualcomm at page 6, Qualcomm also made clear that it would not give TI pass-through rights so that Qualcomm could continue to collect royalties from handset manufacturers that purchase CDMA. So the two key provisions in this contract, and they're denominated as material goals, are patent peace and no pass-through. With Intel, you don't have to worry about it. As a matter of fact, there's a lot more to the Intel story than was told. Intel wanted pass-through rights. That is the biggest single thing that Qualcomm will not give away, because it would ruin the $1 billion they get from the handset manufacturers. The only time that Intel, and the Chancellor saw this, the only time that Intel ever promised that it would pay $30 million in royalties was an agreement they drafted that had pass-through rights, which was rejected by Qualcomm. So, and there was a bunch of other. We had the Qualcomm deposition is in here. There's a whole series of things. And it was the Intel agreement that was the basis of their $18 million damage claim. So if they were damaged by Intel, they were entitled to that damage. What they're not entitled to do is to rip up this contract.
Let me interrupt you here for a moment, counsel. You said that the no pass-through rights was an additional core or goal of the agreement. Was that additional core or goal also determinable from the face of the agreement?
Yes.
As distinguished from extrinsic evidence.
Right. In the beginning of the PPA, in the whereas clauses, it says there is a material goal of this contract to be free from patent infringement. The next one says it is also a material goal that there will be no pass-through rights. And that's where we get to the second question, and that is, why don't we have a trial? We don't have a trial because the undisputed facts show that neither one of those material goals were impacted. Mr. Lou Lupin, the general counsel, testified in direct questions in his deposition, which were specifically relied upon by the Chancellor. He said, this is at page B0385, I don't believe the breach by TI vitiates or undercuts or alters TI's covenants not to assert its patents against Qualcomm. Later he says, I don't think there's anything about what TI has done that could cause anyone to claim pass-through rights or to have a better claim that they have pass-through rights based on this agreement. So what you have, and this is relied on by the Chancellor, what you have is the undisputed testimony of their general counsel that says neither pass-through rights nor patent was affected by TI's breach. So So you don't need a trial because on summary judgment, the undisputed facts show that TI's breach had no effect on patent piece, didn't affect it whatsoever, and didn't affect pass-through.
But there's an assumption in that argument, and here's where I think we could use some help. The agreement says that goal number one is a material goal of this agreement. And then the next paragraph says goal number two is a material goal of this agreement. Your argument, I suppose, necessarily has to be that since there's no reference to goal number three, four, or five, that no matter what the evidence may be, there could be no trial. That is, that those clauses are preclusive and preclude summary judgment as a matter of, that require summary judgment as a matter of law.
Yes and no. There are other provisions that specifically say that a breach would be material. It doesn't say it's a goal of the agreement. So you could, but they're not relevant here. It's 9.1.
The other side is arguing, yes, we agree that the agreement, that the contract as written specifies goal number one and two, but there's also goal number three, and it wasn't put in the agreement, but it is material,
okay. And
we're entitled to show that. What's wrong with that argument?
What's wrong with that argument are the cases that have been decided, like the Underwriters case and the Boesky case, and that is to say, those cases said no matter how important confidentiality may be, or in the face of a testimony that says, I would not have signed the agreement if there was no confidentiality, even though it's that important, unless confidentiality is the core of the agreement, a breach is not so material as to require termination, and you get a claim for damages.
Well, and that, following up on Justice Jacobs' question, it seems analogous to some transactional things that we're familiar with, where there are postponable events of default, non-postponable events of default, and you have subrogation where sometimes the default on a junior security will trigger a default on a senior security. Here, you seem to say that as a matter of summary judgment, you can look at this agreement and ascertain which breaches entitle you to damages and which breaches entitle you to termination.
I say that you can look at the contract, and that's why I said there's a two-step analysis. You can look at the contract and see what the material goals are, what the essence of it, what the core of it is. This is a cross-license patent agreement, is what it is, okay? And confidentiality is just an ancillary provision. You have to look at the breach. The breach was the confidentiality. You have to look and say, did that destroy those material goals? And that's why not only the testimony of Mr. Lupin, but the concessions that Mr. Grimm on behalf of Qualcomm made at the hearing, because the chancellor picked up on this right away, and he asked Mr. Grimm. Mr. Grimm was going through all the undisputed facts. Recall, they filed a motion for summary judgment. This is new that they want a trial. They filed a motion for summary judgment. We filed a motion for summary judgment. And while Mr. Grimm was reciting all the undisputed facts, the chancellor stopped him. This is at page B0583. Can we add, this is the chancellor, can we add as an undisputed fact for the record that there continues to be patent peace between Qualcomm and TI? Mr. Grimm, yes, Your Honor. The court, can we add to the undisputed facts that there is a continuing payment of royalties by handset manufacturers and there has been no pass-through? Answer, yes, Your Honor. In the chancellor's opinion, which they say doesn't deal with facts, it does. At page 3, he recites that he does step one. He says the PPA is not a confidentiality agreement, nor was confidentiality identified by the parties as a critical term or goal of the PPA. The root of the agreement, applying New York law, or the essence of the contract was patent peace between Qualcomm and TI. The agreement itself makes this abundantly clear. So he looks at the four corners of the agreement to see what the core is. He then turns to the facts, and here's where we get into, we need a trial or not. Well, we don't, because we have undisputed facts that patent peace and pass-through were not affected. He says Qualcomm Senior Vice President General Counsel conceded, and then he reads the provisions that I read earlier. So our position is that they've had their trial. As any good judge would do, if the material issues of fact are undisputed, although they are fact issues, if they are undisputed, they then become matter of law, and he doesn't need a trial.
Well, I think the Court of Chancery has changed its rule since you were litigating this. They now have a rule that says cross motions for summary judgment are deemed to be a stipulation to decide it on a paper record unless either side says something to the contrary. But that wasn't in effect at the time you were doing this litigation. I understand your point, and it makes sense that if you have a major agreement, some admittedly insignificant breach shouldn't allow you to walk away from the agreement and defeat what you wanted to accomplish. I guess what we're trying to find out is where along the spectrum do we identify the things that are insignificant and the things that are material.
Your first point, Justice Holland, was a good one because we had a whole day of oral arguments. So that funny enough, the later trial only took 2.5 hours. The arguments on all the summary judgments took all day. I got to argue first on this issue, and he looked me right in the eye. Chancellor Chandler says, now, you guys both filed motions for summary judgment. Nobody's going to be up in front of the Supreme Court arguing that there's a fact issue. And I waffled when it came to breach because I still think we had a lot to talk about on breach. Of course, breach has been decided against me. And I did say, as to this point, you're right, you can decide as a matter of law. I then, when I was preparing for this, was saying, I hope he asked Mr. Grimm the same thing, and he didn't. So that's Mr. Grimm took a position.
That's why they amended the rule.
We have that in Texas too, and the judges toil with that because there are times, I suppose, when it wouldn't apply. But I think here both sides teed it up, and I think if you carefully read the PPA and you put it next to New York law, it is clear that it was only a ancillary provision. And if you look at the Boesky case, Judge Pollack in the Southern District, you couldn't get a more flagrant breach. In that case, FMC was trying to do a reorganization. Their investment banker leaked the reorganization to Ivan Boesky. Ivan Boesky is buying the stock. You can't get a more deliberate act than that. And in that case, and we cite it, Judge Pollack says, I know confidentiality was important. I know maybe you wouldn't have signed the agreement, but that doesn't make any difference. The core of that agreement was, let's get the reorganization done, and that was done. And therefore, we're not going to blow up the whole thing and blow up the contract. You're always free to sue for damages. And I think it's important for this court to realize that Qualcomm had its day in court and walked away from it. It had a claim for damages. It's not as if TI breached and it's going to run back to Texas and hide. We were there prepared and ready to face a damage claim we thought was invalid because of what I told you about the Intel deal, but nevertheless, they would have got their day in court. And if this thing was such an impact, they would have had their opportunity. And throughout the course of the litigation, they kept saying they were damaged here, they were damaged here, they were damaged here. At the end of the day, it only ended up to Intel. And Chancellor Chandler gave them their day in court. They said, come back. We set an early trial date in August. We were all ready to go. And a couple weeks before trial, they drop it.
Well, it's an aside. Their response is they did a cost-benefit analysis, and based on what they thought they'd have to disclose at trial, they'd rather walk away.
I'm not fussing with them. I mean, I got out of a damage trial. The point I'm trying to make is it's not as if they didn't have a claim for damages. And to answer Justice Jacobs' question to Qualcomm, they did not raise that there was a different standard. We were operating under the New York law as applied. There was none of this willfulness differentiates the standards. And if you look at the case law in New York, materiality is always an issue, and the willfulness is kind of just ignored. I could find no case where they said, oh, gee, the breach was immaterial. Didn't make any difference, but since it was willful, we're going to terminate the agreement. Terminating an agreement is a very serious deal, especially here, because they get to continue to have patent fees from us, and we don't. And we have some valuable patents, notwithstanding what Mr. Bramsek said. So this is a big, big step. And the Chancellor saw that, gave them every opportunity to present a damage claim, and when they analyzed the contract, it was clear that this was not a material breach.
So you're making two arguments. One is that the willfulness lowers materiality standard was not argued below. And secondly, even if it had been, it's wrong.
Yeah,
the argument's wrong.
It's verbiage is never paid attention to. Every case that I've seen decides it on materiality. It says material and willful, and that it doesn't lower the standard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good
Respectfully, Your Honor, and this honorable court, I think Mr. Murphy has really said it all here when he says this breach of confidentiality was ancillary. That was an ancillary term of this agreement. It could never, a breach of that could never rise to a material breach. Well, we've argued below, and we're here at Qualcomm is here arguing today, that we believe a breach of confidentiality can be ancillary, can be material, rise to the level of material breach, and that's why we're entitled to present to the court at trial the facts and circumstances surrounding this breach. It cannot be, under the applicable law, determined from the face of the contract, and Chancellor Chandler, on the motion to dismiss, cited the case law that controls that proposition. That was not what was applied on the summary judgment.
Mr. Abramczyk, this was this agreement was one that involved potentially hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion, depending on the volume of business that would be done pursuant to it. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it was heavily lawyered by both sides.
I expect that it was, Your Honor.
And so heavily lawyered that in this case, the parties actually articulated in the opening paragraphs of the agreement what the goals of the agreement were. Correct.
Well, Your Honor.
Yes.
No. Respectfully.
They didn't state that one of the goals was patent peace and another was no faster?
Your Honor, they absolutely stated that one of the goals was patent peace, one of the goals was no pass-through, but as the court had pointed out...
And they could have stated that no disclosure was a goal. Could they not?
Your Honor, they really couldn't for this reason. The no disclosure as a material goal or as a per se material breach was something that the parties were highly unlikely to be able to ever reach agreement upon, because there could be circumstances in which a breach of confidentiality... Remember, the agreement doesn't say that the parties can never speak to anyone, any third party, ever about the terms of the agreement. There are certain very limited circumstances in which such disclosures could be made. So,
And that's provided for in the non-disclosure substantive provision, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And you're saying that the lawyers who were skilled enough to draft that provision weren't skilled enough to capture that thought in a goals articulation?
I think, Your Honor, because it was so plain to both sides that this penumbra of the confidentiality arrangement and obligation put over all of the terms of the agreement, that to call it out to say that any breach of confidentiality would necessarily be a material breach was not an agreement that the parties could achieve. Importantly, on that point, if the court looks at the agreement here, and as the Chancellor noted in his motion to dismiss opinion below, there are provisions of this agreement that the parties explicitly reference as material goals. There are other important goals that aren't referenced as material goals. That's not the controlling part of the test as to whether the breach of confidentiality rises to the level of material breach. But also, there are provisions in the agreement that say that in addition to any other material breaches of this agreement, this is in 9.1D, in addition to any other material breaches of this agreement, a breach of the reps and warranties would be a material breach. So it is plain within the four corners of the contract that other breaches can rise to the level of material breach, even though they're not specifically identified in the preamble, as you say, Justice Jacobs, or other places in the contract. That was contemplated. And because no one can determine at the beginning of the contract what might rise to the level of material breach, the courts look at this in a fact and circumstances test, and that is what Qualcomm has not had the benefit of here.
Well, what about the fact that you didn't have enough of a case or enough damages to be willing to go to trial on that issue? Doesn't that tend to suggest that this was not a material breach?
Not at all, Your Honor. As Justice Holland points out, that really was a cost-benefit business decision. We have very, very clever tacticians on the Texas Instruments side here who know where the pressure points are and knew that faced with handing over to them, even in the context of this litigation, the most sensitive information about our two-tiered licensing program that we had, when they've already were already in court over their failure to keep what they had been given confidential, could be business suicide to us. and we made the judgment not to submit that information to them and forego the damages, the money damages on that. It is not at all an indication that this breach is not material. It cuts right to the core of what we needed from this agreement, and that's the evidence that we presented below a summary judgment and respectfully want the opportunity to go to trial on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. We appreciate your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.
Please rise.